The city of Fayetteville is outlining priorities for arts and culture moving forward.
One of the things I love about this plan is that it's really a community-driven plan. And so it defines some roles for the city and the arts and culture division to take on. But it also identifies the roles that the community can take on to sort of fill those gaps.
The city is adopting an arts and culture plan, and we'll hear more about it on this Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 23rd, 2025. I'm Kyle Kellums. Also today, the state of the state's economy.
For most of 2024, broadly, the state economy has done well. And by that, you know, when you look at the headline indicators, unemployment rate close to 3.4% for our state, which is not the historic low, but very close to it.
A preview of the annual Walton College Economic Conference later this hour, and a big grant to help the Jones Center in Springdale welcome more patrons. First, we welcome this news from NPR.
Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families celebrates the 20th annual Soup Sunday, February 2nd, at the Rogers Convention Center from 4:30 to 7 p.m. This family-friendly fundraiser includes soups and breads, desserts, live music, and auction items. For tickets, aradvocates.org or 479-927-9800. KUAF Public Radio presents The Coffee Tour, a series of community meetups at local coffee shops across our listening area. Listeners and guests are invited to join KUAF team members for the next tour stop at 211 Cafe in the Bentonville Public Library, February 4th from 5 to 6:30 p.m. for coffee and conversation. More information at kuaf.com/coffeetour.
This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 23rd, 2025. I'm Kyle Kellums. On this date in 1812, the ground was shaking in eastern Arkansas and eastern Missouri. What may be the longest recorded prolonged earthquake episode began on this date 213 years ago. The seismic activity actually began the previous month, now called the New Madrid earthquake. Nothing quite as dramatic as that on our show today, though in a few minutes, we learn about a just-adopted arts and culture plan for Fayetteville. And a new novel set in 1970s Georgia explores power, class, and friendship. We'll talk with author Nancy Hartney about the Blue Bottle Tree. And an all-star jazz ensemble of young musicians is about to assemble. More about the 2025 edition of the Jazz All-Stars in our second half hour. This week, the city of Fayetteville adopted a strategic 10-year art and culture plan. The 66-page guide lays out policy recommendations and goals for the city to grow and sustain its art scene. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth spoke with Joanna Sheehan Bell, the city's arts and culture director, about the new plan in our studio yesterday.
If you could just sort of walk me through how this plan came about and what the goal is in producing this guide.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the arts and cultural director for the city of Fayetteville. I'm the first person to serve in this role. And sort of when I was brought on board, one of the things that was sort of we decided we needed to do first was sort of decide sort of what's the vision for arts and culture in the city of Fayetteville? Where are we now? Where do we want to go, right? And that's really what this plan does. It defines some roles for the city and the arts and culture division to take on, but it also identifies the roles that the community can take on to sort of fill those gaps and serve some of those needs.
Speaking of that community aspect, you know, you involved, it was like 1,200 people were involved in the arts community who helped sort of guide this plan. Can you talk about how you went about finding those people and sort of what that entire research process was like?
Yeah, so we had a series of public meetings, which invited community to sort of come and be part of the creative convergence. We also held individual discipline sort of focus groups, you know, sit down and talk to just the members of the film community, sit down and talk to just the musicians and things like that, and like did some pop-ups in some different events across the city.
And was there anything that came out of those, like a through line from a lot of those conversations that was surprising to you or that really stuck with you in hearing those conversations?
Yeah, I would say the thing that really sort of stuck out the most for me was this word access, right? It just kept coming up in every conversation. So access can be literally, how do I physically get to that space? It can mean, how do I get the keys to unlock that space or how do I get to rent that space? It can also be sort of about, like, do I have this immediately available to me in the public sphere? But it ultimately came down to everyone in the community saying, I want a different way to get to the art. I want more art in my life.
Yeah.
And so that's really the thing that stuck with me.
There were kind of five big community priority takeaways that came from this. Walk through what some of those are and maybe how you got to this model that you presented.
Yeah. And so what we did was we sort of looked deeply at the gaps that came up in our research. And then we also sort of were talking to communities about how we might solve for the gaps, right? And that's kind of how we ended up with the community priorities. The first of these is to sort of cultivate. This priority sort of acknowledges that what we have is really rich and amazing here. And what we need to do is sort of spend some time nurturing that sector and making sure it has sort of some of the basic things that it needs, right? Then the second sort of community priority that we identified is quite similar in that it also recognizes what we have, but what we need to sustain what we have is additional resources, right? So as we grow, if as a city we're not planning sort of where municipal resources go to support this important sector, it won't necessarily thrive by itself. That's the very definition of a public good. Public goods experience market failure, and art is just like a public good. And then after that, we start thinking about sort of priorities that focus on growth, right? So we think about creative spaces, the places that we already have, and how do we break down barriers to access some of those spaces? And then we start talking about sort of placemaking. And placemaking or placekeeping is the thing that really makes a city feel like a home, right? It's like, so these are the things that we can all share together. And so this is where sort of formalizing a public art program comes into play. And then finally, we're sort of looking at leading in the field, right? How can we be sort of leaders not only of Northwest Arkansas, but of the Mid-America arts region?
Talking about the gaps that you're seeing in where we are in arts and culture right now, what really are those? And what, you know, what were the barriers to getting us to pull those levers in the past, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not necessarily any barriers. It's just whether or not it was the right time, right? Yeah. There wasn't sort of a strategic plan to sort of get us there, right? We can sort of see where other cities have already been, like a Fort Collins, Colorado, from an 80,000-person city to a 150,000-person city. What did they do? And we can look back and sort of say, okay, now it's time for something like a public art ordinance or sort of a percent for the arts ordinance, something like that.
And I know one of the recommendations and one of the areas that you guys are identifying is the need for more public funding for art, more municipal owned spaces. So can you talk a little bit about what that would look like and maybe where that funding might come from?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think we're necessarily saying that we need municipal-owned spaces, but I do think there's something in the conversation that we need to sort of study sort of the facilities that we have. We have a lot of siloing in our community, world-class facilities that exist sort of for just university students, world-class facilities that exist just for high school students, right? Like, how can we open those up and sort of, like, share a little bit more in those resources?
So going back to access, like we were talking about earlier, at the city council meeting, when this was approved, one of the big issues was housing, accessibility, affordability of the city. That's a big issue that people are concerned with. And I think some people were concerned that maybe this plan didn't directly address that in the way that they were hoping or didn't feel it was enough. Can you respond to that at all?
Yeah. I mean, first, I want to say that this is a 30,000-foot plan, right? And the idea is not to necessarily be prescriptive at this juncture. This sort of lays out the priorities for 10 years of work. So I can share that one of the things that we announced today, actually, on the heels of approving the plan, is that we're bringing in ArtSpace, who is a sort of nationally known real estate developer for artist live-work housing. We're conducting a feasibility study for them to possibly consider a project here in Fayetteville. But again, that doesn't necessarily, that solves like a very small piece of our housing concerns, right? So again, an arts plan is never going to solve all of our accessibility issues or all of our sort of housing concerns. But I do think when you layer it on top of our economic vitality plan and our transportation plan and our climate action plan and our parks system master plan, right? And you start to link all of these things together, you can really see what direction the city is going and how we might solve for some of these bigger, more complex issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the city has all of these, like you're saying, all these plans that are they're being laid out. And maybe if you're only seeing one or two of them at a time, it can be hard to see how they all link up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, trying to address issues like housing, climate change, why now for an art study? Why is that important? And how does it feed back into those other bigger issues?
When a city gets to about our size is right when you start to lose that organic placemaking. And that's when you have to plan for your arts and culture because it won't necessarily be as organically rich as it once was. It speaks to affordability in some ways, right? Because artists are often the first to sort of make a place feel like a home, right? They're there and they make sort of, they imbue the community with a spirit of collaboration and that culture that we all share. And the idea that you have to sort of plan for that space is sometimes a challenge, and it happens right at this population mark.
And for you, I mean, you're in a new position that has never
yes.
The city's never had this before. What's been sort of the sense and the reaction from the public of why we're investing in arts and culture and how important it is just to the character of Fayetteville, I guess, why that matters to people?
I deeply believe that art is a public good, right? That it is something that is non-rivalrous and that we can all share and enjoy together. And when we have a healthy artist ecology, that's sort of when you have the healthiest kind of city. You know, when you think about civilizations from the past, right? What we remember is what they made. We remember their art, right? And so that's why I think it's really important to have somebody in your municipality thinking about artists in every room.
And so the city has adopted it. It's a 10-year plan. What sort of is the timeline for this and maybe the commitment with the city to implementing some of these things?
Yeah. And so we're really lucky because it like lets us be as responsive as we can be to mm-hmm. opportunities. So it starts as soon as February 4th through 6th when ArtSpace comes to visit us. You'll see things roll out from the plan sort of almost successively over the next, you know, 10 years.
Is there anything within this that you are maybe most excited about?
For me, this is where sort of I think about all of those community members who told us things, whether it was their problems or their complaints, or whether it was sort of their wins or their possible solutions. There's nothing that we wrote down here that didn't come from someone in Fayetteville. And so far, when I've been talking to artists about the plan, they basically have told me that they see their problems and they see their concerns in the plan and they see solutions. So that's my great hope, is that we can sort of make a plan that gets our creative ecology as healthy as it could possibly be.
That was Joanna Sheehan Bell, Arts and Culture Director for the City of Fayetteville, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth in the Karen Taha News Studio yesterday. The country's leading nonprofit developer for the arts, ArtSpace, will conduct a study next month in Fayetteville. Commissioned by the city's Arts and Culture Division and Vitality Department, the new study follows a preliminary study conducted in 2018. This visit will take place February 4th through the 6th, focusing on assessing the potential for creative space development and exploring ways to support the city's arts community. There will be a public meeting Wednesday night, February 5th, from 5 to 7 at the Fayetteville Public Library. ArtSpace representatives will share findings from the 2018 study, discuss current creative space needs, and present ArtSpace model for developing affordable live-work spaces for artists and arts organizations. Lawmakers are rejecting a proposal to allow some hospitals to dispense drugs directly to patients. Senate Bill 58 was presented to a legislative committee yesterday. The bill would have allowed nonprofit hospitals to operate or hold interest in pharmacies. Current Arkansas law forbids that practice. Daniel Mackey is an oncologist at Mercy Hospital in Fort Smith. He testified in favor of the bill, saying access to treatment can be a struggle for patients who need special drugs that aren't available in most retail pharmacies. He says the current mail-in system his hospital uses can be unpredictable.
So I wrote this prescription for an oral chemotherapy pill for one of my patients back in December, and I saw him in the office on Monday. He had yet to start his chemotherapy yet. Because he was still trying to navigate the complex mail-order pharmacy system.
The bill was sponsored by Republican State Senator Jonathan Dismaying of Searcy. Republican Senator Clint Pinzo voted against the bill. In the committee meeting, he said he knows of hospitals with in-house pharmacies.
And those pharmacies are not allowed to fill certain prescriptions under certain insurance companies that are handled by certain PBMs. So when that scenario is brought up, I'm curious, is it because it's a PBM that's getting involved and getting in the way of that patient receiving their drug and they're mandated to use a mail order pharmacy that is owned by the PBM? If that's the scenario, this has nothing to do. This bill will not fix that.
The bill failed to pass the committee through a roll call vote. A resolution for all state agencies in Arkansas to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America in all official state communications is being introduced at the state capitol. Representative Aaron Pilkington, a Republican from Knoxville in Johnson County, filed Arkansas House Resolution 1010 yesterday. The legislation has been referred to the House Management Committee. Three area chefs are semifinalists in the James Beard Foundation Awards, each receiving a nod for being the best chef in the South. Matthew Cooper at Conifer in Bentonville, Rafael Rios of Yeo's in Bentonville, and James Wright of Wright's Barbecue in Johnson are among the 20 chefs nominated. The category covers regions including New Orleans, Miami, and San Juan. Final nominees will be announced April 2nd. The eventual winner will be named at the James Beard Restaurant and Chef Awards in Chicago on June 16th. The Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team can now put a mark in the SEC win column. The Razorbacks last night defeated Georgia 68-65 in Bud Walton Arena. Arkansas now 1-5 in conference action. Next will host Oklahoma Saturday night. The Sooners also with just one conference victory so far. And the Razorback women seek their second SEC win tonight in Nashville, playing Vanderbilt. Arkansas is 1-4 in conference, 8-12 overall.
You're listening to The Human Bird, Joe Belmont, with Byron Harlan, and you're on the Soundbeat. Goethe's Devil did it. Superstitious ship captains and newsroom editors alike forbid it. And NYU philosophy professor Charles Shaw went a step further in a New York Times article in 1931. Whistling, he said, is the unmistakable sign of the moron. It's only the inferior and maladjusted individual who ever seeks emotional relief in such a bird-like act as that of whistling. Joe Belmont would have differed. He made a career out of whistling, impersonating our feathered friends for dozens of recordings in the early 1900s. You've been listening to The Blue Jay and the Thrush, an Edison Blue Amberol cylinder from 1914. Listen to more episodes whenever you want at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 23rd, 2025. I'm Kyle Kelms. Thanks for being with us. The Jones Center will direct a large gift toward helping them lower barriers to the community center. Ozarks at Large's Jack Travis has more.
The Jones Center in Springdale has received more than $500,000 from the Walmart Foundation to increase the community's access to the space. The $550,000 grant will fund discounted Access for Everyone memberships and youth activity scholarships, public programs, and space rental discounts for local nonprofits. Jill Sewell is the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Jones Center. She says the Walmart Foundation's contribution is especially valuable because community centers have a direct effect on the region's health.
The Jones Center is a place for connection. I think that we are strongly leaning into that. And as you know, I've been here for about a year working here. And it's something that you can see when you're here all the time, you know, as the staff is, you see the relationships that people form with each other, you know, in the group fitness classes or in the other, more long-term classes that we host here. But, you know, it's a place where people have birthday parties and they might have, you know, corporate meetings or even weddings, or they come here to see performances. And so all of those things are very communal activities. And, you know, we just know that it's good for you, good for your health, your emotional, mental, physical health to be out interacting with people. And also, of course, here in particular, you know, we do also have those active engagements that people are doing. So even more so, you know, on the health side of things, on your physical body, you are, you know, engaging in activity. And the more you move your body, you know, the healthier your mind is.
According to the CDC, life expectancy in Arkansas fell by more than 1 year in 2021, which is the nation's eighth largest drop. Jones Center officials say one cause for this change is that people are leading increasingly sedentary lifestyles. Research links increased sitting time with cardiovascular disease, obesity, high blood sugar, and cancer, effects that are even greater for those in lower socioeconomic statuses. To combat these trends, the Jones Center uses funds, such as those from the Walmart Foundation, to provide more than 150 public programs in the areas of sports, recreation, arts and culture, and science and technology. Sewell emphasizes the Access for Everyone membership scholarship as another example of how the center keeps with founder Bernice Jones's vision that, quote, all are welcome.
We can provide low-cost memberships and activity fees to households. They apply and are provided the membership based on need. It's needs-based financial help. So we have about 1,300 individuals that were impacted this past year with the scholarship program. And so that means that they, like I said, they can have a membership and participate in the daily activities here. Many of these people are households who have children and, you know, multi-generational. And so the children might come to participate in swim lessons or summer camp and other kinds of camps and activities. And those are all also deeply discounted. But of course, it's also good for the family to be able to come and participate together in things. We have classes that engage, you know, kids and adults, like martial arts or swimming or other things. So people can participate together as a family or as individuals.
Demand for these scholarships is growing, too. In 2024, the Jones Center saw a 40% increase in requests over the previous year. The Access Grant will also support area nonprofits. The Jones Center operates office space for more than 100 nonprofits in its Center for Nonprofits in Rogers and JTL Schott Building in Springdale. The funding allows organizations to continue to occupy the campuses at a discounted rate.
The goal and the point of these nonprofit affiliates and tenants is that we want to provide below market rate leases for them so that they can direct their money and their resources to cover more of what their mission is instead of having increasing overhead costs year over year. And so that's a big part of who we are, and what we do is we support these groups through that program that, again, is also supported and underwritten by the Walmart Foundation.
She highlights a few not-for-profit organizations that operate in Jones Center buildings.
Pedal It Forward had a couple of locations in Northwest Arkansas, and they wanted to add one. And of course, we were in a prime location because, it being in Springdale, we're sort of centrally located. They otherwise had spaces in Fayetteville and Bentonville. We also have the community clinic that, you know, provides health services. I mean, there's just a huge list of them. Like I said, there's 100 of them. So they can be providing services across all spans of life. So, you know, from child care and resources for children, you know, through adulthood and all kinds of things that the community needs. And so we're thrilled to have the space to provide to them and to help them direct their money towards their missions and to really impact the community through this partnership of working together and having this big communal space.
The center will also use the grant to provide free or low-cost community events. Accessible gatherings boost community health by bringing neighbors together and allowing them to be active.
Two that I can highlight for you are Fun Day Sunday, which happens monthly here, and we rotate free a time for the community to either come swim in our indoor pool complex or ice skate in the arena, the indoor ice arena. And so that is, again, it's a free day activity for people. And then another big one that we love is our Splash Bash, which is in the summer. And it's a community block party, essentially, like you would think about in the neighborhood. And again, so it's just welcoming people here. And we set up inflatables and giant water slides and have water balloon fights and hoses and sprinklers and kind of just that throwback summer gathering. And that's where we just really invite the community to come and participate and be together. So we're thrilled to have that and want to do more of that. Like you said, as we grow and as the community grows, the Jones Center, yes, wants to provide more of all of these things.
You can visit thejonescenter.net for more information about memberships, activities, and more. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jack Travis.
This is Ozarks at Large. In the new novel, The Blue Bottle Tree, Susan Butler, nicknamed P after a childhood experience, returns to her small Georgia hometown after living in New York City. She's come back to help her longtime friend and now sister-in-law, Eve, deal with terminal illness, Eve's less-than-noble husband, Major, and Eve's teenage daughter, Janie. It's 1970, and tensions of class and race weigh on the characters in The Blue Bottle Tree. And gothic secrets move our story along, as does Letta Davis, the woman who's been employed by Major for years and lost her husband in an accident at the mill owned by Major Butler. Nancy Hartney's second novel patrols the worlds of greed, safety, friendship, and power. She'll discuss the book Sunday afternoon at 1 at Pearl's Books in downtown Fayetteville. She's with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News studio. Nancy Hartney, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This is a pleasure.
As is your book.
Thank you.
I think if anyone hears your voice, they'll kind of get an idea of why you said it in Georgia in 1970. Why did you pick that era and that location?
I picked Georgia, of course, because my roots are there. I grew up along the South Georgia, North Florida state line. I grew up on a farm. It was a very contentious time during the 1970s because we were deeply involved in Vietnam, and there were many demonstrations, and I wanted to capture some of that because that was part of my history and part of my roots. At any rate, I love both the South and also see that it has a very dark and ugly underbelly.
Well, that's something that Susan notes as well as she comes back from New York City. She's missed where she grew up, her hometown, but she understands the South can be complicated.
Yes, it is. It is indeed. My dedication, as a matter of fact, is to my home community and to the complications that still continue to exist there.
I think many people are familiar with the Blue Bottle Tree, but I didn't really know any of the lore behind a blue bottle tree, as explained this novel. What is a blue bottle tree, and what can it mean for people?
A blue bottle tree is just a old tree or a shrub that has died, usually that has died, and the branches are sawed off and made into stubby holders for bottles. And then bottles are placed on the tree so that they can just sparkle in the sun and be a yard decoration. In rural areas, this was especially a needed thing because people did not have as many yards. Most often they had concrete-type yards, just swept clean of anything. The lore of the blue bottle tree is brought over from our slaveholding days. Many of the slaves or individuals that were transported from Africa here used blue and bottles as something that they caught evil spirits in, haints, as they call them in the South. And These bottle trees dot the landscape. And they go back to a lot of tradition and custom, being that the bottles are blue, and that's a color that the Haints especially liked, but they were also afraid of because it represented water or the sea, and they were afraid of that kind of thing. So people in the South many times painted their shutters or the porch roof blue to fool the Haints so that they would not come into the house and capture things or hold things. The Haints in the often or were believed to go inside the bottles at night, and then they couldn't get back out. It's much like a fly getting in a bottle. But the sun then, when it came up in the morning, usually burned them up, and so the Haints were prevented from doing any damage. But now, Haints can also be benign as well. Some are malicious and mean-spirited. Others are just mischievous.
One of the characters in the Blue Bottle Tree, Major, isn't a Haint, but he is more than mischievous. He's not a good person.
He is not a good person. Many of the people that tasted power in small towns allowed that power to corrupt them in some way. And Major was one of those. He left for World War II, fought in World War II, and came home not quite right because he had seen too much killing and too much carnage during the war.
You mentioned power in a small town, and so many of the characters in the Blue Bottle Tree, women, are trapped without enough power. Letta, because she's a black woman in 1970s Georgia, even when she tries to get a bus ticket, she's condescended to. Someone says, are you sure you can go? You're not leaving some poor woman's kitchen duties undone. Eve, Major Butler's second wife, trapped by a terminal illness. Her daughter Janie, who has this affinity for bird calls, trapped by near blindness. And then Susan, who's come back from New York City. I find her the most interesting character because she's trying to obtain power the best way she can.
Susan P. is what is called at that time a spinster woman. And she is trapped, if you will, by her lack of input into the family fortune or what's left of it. Major did rebuild it. But she is also trapped by the cultural norms and the social norms of the 1970s. And went to New York where it was possible to blend in with the general population.
There are some mysteries that get unrevealed or unspooled. There's some secrets. How did you figure out what you wanted to be sort of the backstory of this novel?
You know, I am what you call a pantster. I sit on my seat, on my pants, and write from the seat of my pants, as opposed to someone that plots out and defines a novel. So you will notice that. The thing that really set me off is to remember so many times in a mystery novel you hear the phrase, ah, the butler did it. Well, it's not exactly the butler that is behind a lot of the action, but it is the two women, Susan P. and Letta. Letta is certainly powerless in one sense, but quite powerful in another sense because she can manipulate and does know secrets about the family.
Well, a lot of it gets put into motion by Eve as well as she is dying.
Yes, yes. When Susan P. first arrives home, Eve calls her into the bedroom where she is dying, and talks with her, and they have a bowl of peach ice cream together and talk about how hot it is. But then Eve drops all of that and says, "You have to promise me something." And her wish for Susan P. is, "Don't bury me next to Major.
Right.
I have spent my life with him, and I don't want to spend all eternity lying next to him." So she asked for something other than a regular funeral.
One of the things I loved about reading The Blue Bottle Tree was I was reading as we had this cold snap in Northwest Arkansas, and the temperatures were, you know, wind chills
yes.
below zero. Ah, this felt so warm. This is such a warm book. Susan arrives in May in Georgia, and it's just, you do a very good job describing a summer.
Well, summer is the thing that we in the South are known for.
Yeah.
I have friends in the North that, and not really in the North, but further North, that say, "Oh my God, I would love living in the South, except that it's too damn hot in
it
the summer." And I have to say, yep, it is. But the weather and the land take on a character and a role. Because I think that land and temperature and terrain change people and mold them so that they are they have a relationship with the land and with the temperature, whether they realize it or not. I think as we've moved away from farms and from the ruralness of our South, we have in some ways lost some of that touch with the land and with the temperature and with the weather. But it still creeps up. It's still there.
Sunday afternoon, you'll be at Pearls.
I will be at Pearls, our wonderful little bookstore down just off the square. I'll be there from 1 to 3, and it's just kind of a chat and look at books and look at other stuff. And if you wish, purchase a book there.
The novel is The Blue Bottle Tree, Sunday afternoon from 1 to 3. Nancy Hartney will discuss the book's on copies. Book published by Ozark Hollow Press. Nancy Hartney, congratulations on the novel. Thanks for coming
Thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Robert Ginsberg, host of Shades of Jazz. Robert, whenever you come, first of all, welcome.
Thank you, Kyle.
Whenever you come in here, we always have to have a big number. How many years Shades of Jazz has been on the air? How many years there's been a summer jazz concert series? We're getting up there with the All-Star Jazz Ensemble.
Hey, I'm just getting up there, Kyle. I notice now wherever I go, I seem to be the oldest guy in the room. So, yeah, the numbers are adding up. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz All-Star Youth Program, which is a jazz education program tailored for high school students, is now in its 9th season. And it's really been a rewarding experience because we've had great turnouts for this. There's a real interest among high school musicians who want to really do a deep dive into learning how to play jazz. And a lot of the students have gone on to get scholarships to Berklee School of Music and UNT, North Texas State University. So every year it just seems to be getting better and better. And we also know that have noticed that the high school programs have kind of upped their game right along with us in offering more opportunities for students. So this is really designed to enhance what all of the great band instructors in our regional high schools are doing already, but we're kind of bringing it all together. We recruit from like 12 different schools, audition kids to be in a big band, and it's been a very fruitful progress that we have made in the program.
There's an audition process, and applicants need before the end of this month to apply.
That's right. It's open to anybody. You can audition for free. It's a great experience auditioning. And that auditioning ends January. I'm sorry. The registration for auditioning ends January 29th. The auditions take place the first weekend in February. February 1st and 2nd. We'll audition one group down in Fayetteville at Walton Arts Center and another group up at Thaden School. But anybody that's interested in auditioning for the band, and everybody should try out. It's an easy audition, very open, and they should register and check it out.
12-week program, approximately?
It's about 12 weeks. Every Sunday from throughout February, March, and April, we rehearse on Sundays. Half of the rehearsals are up at Thaden in Bentonville, and half of them are down here in Fayetteville. And the kids work with jazz professionals. Plus, we always contract an internationally known jazz artist who provides repertoire for the kids to work on. And then he's going to do two rehearsals with the kids this year and perform with them in the final concert at Walton Arts Center. This year, it's an internationally renowned artist, Steve Wilson, who plays in the Maria Schneider Orchestra. He's recorded on over 100 recordings. He's played with Herbie Hancock, name somebody. Mm-hmm. And Steve is a great jazz educator as well. So that's always the highlight for the kids, to be able to get on stage with a jazz superstar.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because it's not just rehearsals. There's a performance. There's recordings.
Yes. We do a recording every year. Once the kids are getting close to that final performance, we bring them into a recording studio. Sometimes we record the concert live, and they get a chance to hear what they sound like. So that's part of it, and getting that experience of what it is to record the music. And then the performance with our star is always, as I say, the highlight.
You mentioned that this has kind of worked hand in glove with high school programs around the region, but you don't have to be in one of those high school programs to audition.
No, this is open to anyone. We advertise it as 9th through 12th grade age group. Some of our most incredible students have gotten in when they were in the 8th grade. We will not turn anyone down who wants to audition, because we feel that performance and studying this music is important. But if for any musician, working that auditioning muscle, getting over the fear of auditioning, is also a really valuable experience. So we encourage kids to come and audition. As I say, a lot of the regional auditions can be intimidating. It's a blind audition. They don't get to see any of the instructors. The instructors don't see them. There's a certain tension that goes along with it. This is open. Everybody's in the room together. They can ask questions, and it's cool to see that process unfold as well.
And then the performance, that's open to the public as well.
Absolutely. The final performance, we're actually going to have two concerts this year. The big one will be at Walton Arts Center, and that'll be on Monday, I believe it's April 28th, whatever that Monday is. But we're going to do another performance a week before that up at Thaden School. And I should mention that this program was born out of the desire to give a greater opportunity for kids to really dig into what it is to play jazz, because typically the high schools focus on concert band and marching band, and the jazz programs are not always that great, and there might not even be a instructor in the high schools that is really a jazz musician. That has changed. We have noticed that the high school band programs are getting better and better, but this still provides that opportunity to really dig in and for the students to intermingle from school to school and play in a band together.
Let's say again for the parents who might be listening, scholarships can be at the end of this.
Absolutely, Kyle. I'm so glad you brought that up, because if students have financial needs, again, we don't want to turn anybody down. The mission of this program is to help bring this music to the educational system that already exists and kind of up the game on that. So no one gets turned down.
DigJazz.com for more information.
DigJazz.com. All of the information is on that webpage as far as the education program. And also for people that just want to keep up with jazz events, we have our weekly jazz newsletter that we email out. That's free to anyone that just wants to get an email once a week with jazz events.
You brought with you some music from a previous All-Star session.
This is the recording from the All-Star group from 2022. And I think you'll hear it's pretty amazing the level that these kids can achieve in terms of their performance skills, because I can tell you the first rehearsal didn't sound anything like this.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Kyle.
Rosewood is performed by the 2024 Jazz All-Star Youth Ensemble. Auditions for the 2025 Jazz All-Star Youth Ensemble, Saturday, February 1st at Walton Arts Center, Sunday, February 2nd at Thaden School in Bentonville. Here's the date to remember. Sign-up deadline, January 29th. Learn much more at digjazz.com. Don't forget, you can listen to Robert Ginsberg's Shades of Jazz Friday nights at 10 on 91.3 KUAF. Saturdays from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. on KUAF3.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm your host, Roby Brock. In a little over a week, Northwest Arkansas will be the epicenter of economic conversation. The University of Arkansas Walton College of Business will host its annual economic conference led by economist Mervyn Jebaraj. He's our guest on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at arkansasstatechamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. Member FDIC.
Mervyn Jebaraj is the economist at the University of Arkansas Walton College of Business and director of the Center for Business and Economic Research. He'll lead a team of national and international economists a week from Friday at the Rogers Convention Center. What's the state of the state and regional economy? And what can we expect to hear at the conference? I caught up with Jebaraj to find out.
All right, we got a lot to talk about because the economy is in a state of flux right now. I want you to start first with the state's economy, and I want you to tell me, give me your assessment of the state's economy. Are we in a good place, a bad place? Where we got places to grow?
Yeah, I mean, I think for most of 2024, broadly, the state economy has done well. And by that, you know, when you look at the headline indicators, unemployment rate close to 3.3, 3.4% for our state, which is not the historic low, but very close to it. And then adding close to about 20,000 jobs in the last year. So overall indicators look pretty good. Wages were growing in Arkansas as well. But again, as with has been the case in previous years, that growth is not necessarily broad-based in the state of Arkansas. So I said, you know, 20,000 jobs added, about 12 to 13,000 of those were just in Central Arkansas and Northwest Arkansas, slightly more in Central Arkansas than Northwest Arkansas. And most of those in both places were in healthcare, in construction. In Central Arkansas, there was a good growth in manufacturing. In Northwest Arkansas, there was a good amount of growth in local governments, so school teachers and those types of jobs. So that's where we've seen the growth in our state, and that has helped the overall headline numbers. But that also means that we haven't seen significant growth in some of our other metro areas around our state and in some of the more rural communities. So, you know, again, broad headline figures, wages are up, unemployment rate remains low. And we added close to 20,000 jobs last year, but there's still parts of our state that are left behind from that growth, some that haven't seen that growth in several years, and that hasn't changed. And then, you know, some large sectors like manufacturing have done well or better in the last year, but then other ones like agriculture, for example, has struggled through the last year, particularly as commodity prices have been fairly low. in the last year, and then the previous year there was drought and things like that. So we've had some ongoing issues in some major sectors in our state, but also some strengths and positives going forward for some other sectors like manufacturing in our state.
Usually when the state GDP does very well, it is because of agriculture. But as you just indicated, agriculture has struggled this past year and in a couple of previous years. Yet our state GDP was pretty solid. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I mean, so if you think about the kinds of things that contribute a lot to GDP, so GDP, again, is measuring final sales of products. It takes a lot of bushels of corn or soybeans or whatever else to make up one airplane that comes off the manufacturing line in Central Arkansas, or even a few different missiles that come off the manufacturing line in Camden. So those things just have way higher dollar value, and we have invested significantly more in those activities. So when we think about conflicts going around the world in the Middle East, Ukraine, as well, and the amount of aid that the United States has provided both of these countries in both of these regions, a lot of that weapons manufacturing has happened in the United States. A lot of that has also happened here in Arkansas. So there has been significant increase in GDP that comes from the sale of those types of systems. And then broadly, we've seen growth in steel manufacturing here in Arkansas that has been exported to Canada and Mexico, which is important to keep in mind as we start discussing tariffs once again as it relates to those countries. So those sectors of the state, you know, there may not be a ton of jobs, but they certainly contribute positively to GDP.
Let's talk about this transition. We're going from President 46 to President 47. Joe Biden has passed the torch to Donald Trump. What condition does Joe Biden leave the U.S. economy? What does Trump inherit as an economy?
Well, judging by the outcome of the election, you might think that the economy is not doing great, as you know, and that was probably the reason for the political change in DC, but that's actually not the case. The economy has done well for the past 2 years. So I'll say this is maybe not as good as the economy that Bill Clinton passed to George W. Bush in 2000, at the end of 2000 to 2001. But it is, in several indicators, you know, sometimes about as good, if not just a little bit under. So I think the unemployment rate remaining fairly low is a very good measure of that. GDP growth has been very close to 3% for the last couple of years, which is the target that the Trump administration has set out for their term as well in the upcoming years. And then the, you know, headline inflation rate has dropped to somewhere between 2.3 and 2.7%, depending on which measure you're looking at. So not at 2%, which is, you know, the long-term target that the Federal Reserve has, but very close to that. So overall, I would say with the high, you know, job growth in the United States, about 180,000 jobs each month added in our economy, the low unemployment rate, the close to 3% GDP growth, I think this is a very healthy economy to pass from one administration to another. And it allows the new administration to work from a position of strength as opposed to a position of weakness.
January 31st, there is the major annual economic conference that you always host up in Northwest Arkansas. It's always a great event. I'm even making plans to be there. You'll be pleased to see me in the audience smiling at you, I'm sure. Tell people the details of that, who's coming, what to expect.
Yeah, so we've this is the 31st annual Arkansas Business Forecast Luncheon that we are hosting at the Rogers Convention Center. On January 31st at 11:30 a.m., we have an international economy forecaster, Dana Peterson from the conference board. And then we have a domestic economy forecaster, Sam Cater from Freddie Mac, who will also talk about housing broadly, nationally, and here in Arkansas as well. And then I will be presenting the Arkansas state forecast and forecast of the different regions in Arkansas. So it's a great event. A lot of people come together. It's sort of a big business event where people really want to talk to each other more than they want to listen to the economists.
That's Mervin Jebaraj, economist at the University of Arkansas Walton College of Business and director of the Center for Business and Economic Research. He's part of our cover story in the latest Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. You can keep up with all of our news and reporting every day at nwabusinessjournal.com.
I'm Roby Brock. Take care. We'll see you next time.
Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3 KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Daniel Carruth, Jack Travis, Robert Ginsburg, Roby Brock in the newsroom at Little Rock Public Radio. I'm Kyle Kellums.
The Scott Family Amazium's Expanding Futures campaign is here, a $25 million expansion initiative to reimagine what's possible for play, learning, and connection in Northwest Arkansas. Featuring a new Early Learner Education Center, a nature-inspired outdoor playscape, and more versatile spaces to host community workshops and events. Details on how to get involved available at amazium.org. Walton Arts Center's 10x10 Arts Series presents Beau Soleil avec Michael Doucet, Thursday, January 30th at 7 p.m. The first Cajun band ever to win a Grammy, their music combines New Orleans jazz, swamp pop, and zydeco with country and bluegrass, led by fiddler and vocalist Michael Doucet. WaltonArtsCenter.org for tickets.